Hello and welcome to another Glenbrook podcast. I'm sat today in a fantastic office in Liverpool with an old friend and ex-colleague, Chris Bliss from Momentum Group. Hello, Chris.
Morning, Guy. Less of the old, please, if you don't mind.
Well, you've been always been a father figure, Chris, in my career over the many years. We first met, I remember it vividly, in September 1999 in Basingstoke. Tell us a bit about that.
I can vividly remember that as well, Guy, actually, when we were finishing Festival Place in Basingstoke. I think you're probably referring to the night before we opened, where there was a lot of stress and pressure going on, and tensions were quite high. So it's probably the memorable moment.
So Festival Place was a scheme I went to work on when I arrived at Grosvenor in 1999. It opened on the 22nd of October 2002.
That's correct.
Yeah. And Chris was running Basingstoke Festival Place. It was called the Walk Shopping Centre, and then went on to run Festival Place.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that scheme, Chris, and what you were doing then on that.
Yeah, it was an interesting scheme because I joined Grosvenor a couple of years before that, just at the point where they bought the Walk Shopping Centre from the Prudential. Prior to that, they were due to build a new build shopping centre right alongside an existing scheme and in two different ownerships, and that clearly was bonkers. So somebody at some point decided that there was a deal to be done, and I arrived just after the purchase. So inherited 500,000 square feet of pretty downtrodden, tired 1960s, 70s shopping centre, and started to regear the team and work with the design team and the development team into turning it into a regional 1 million square feet shopping centre, where we refurbished the existing 500,000 and built 500,000 new build. As you know, the rest, it now trades, I think, very well. It's a good, successful scheme.
Well, some of the listeners might remember that Top Gear went and filmed a episode in the shopping centre when it was chasing, I think a Corvette was chasing something small down the mall, wasn't it?
That's right. That's my understanding. I wasn't there at that point, but yeah.
So we dived in there straight away into where Chris and I met in Festival Place, and very memorable and enjoyable years they were too. But we're chatting to Chris today because we're sat in Liverpool at his new office on Temple Square. Momentum Group have taken a new office from Glenbrook in the Temple office building on Dale Street and have done a fantastic job. And I said to Chris, we must sit down and actually put this on tape and have a listen to the story about Momentum, because Chris's career has been really interesting. And he'll tell us a bit about how he was not really directly in property development or management for years and then changed his career. So I think there's a really interesting lesson and message about how you can change your career if you really want to and believe in it. And Chris is still doing that now and changing and shaking things up. Then we're going to talk a bit about Liverpool One, where we both came up from Festival Place and arrived at Liverpool One at different times, but did very different jobs. And then Chris somehow ended up in 2008 running Liverpool One for 10 years. So we're going to talk about how management has changed over those 10 years and what Liverpool One was like to manage in the early days and what it was like when he left there in 2018. And then we're going to talk about Momentum Group and why I think it's a really interesting business and what they do. So Chris, stretching back to your days at college, or you were from Basingstoke area, I believe?
Well, started off born and bred in Tring, really, in Hertfordshire. Moved over to Buckinghamshire, literally on the border, and started my career actually not really knowing what I wanted to do, other than at that time I had a passion for live theatre. I used to do quite a lot of sort of amateur dramatics, working on the stage, technical work. So I guess there was always a hint there back at, you know, as a childhood working with my dad, that there was something. And I always wanted to be an electrician. I was wanting to go into the theatre, all the careers advice and my parents' advice was, don't go into the theatre, you really shouldn't be doing that, you need to get yourself a proper job, why don't you go into the RAF, I think was one of the suggestions. But eventually I was very lucky, I picked up one of the old-fashioned apprenticeships with Nestlé. They were based in Aylesbury. They were making soups, and I became one of their high-speed packaging engineers, but not as an electrician. They didn't want electricians at that time. They wanted mechanical engineers. So the spanners came out, and we were maintaining machinery and the packaging room floor. And the promise from them to me was that they would dual skill me and make me an electrician. That didn't happen. And so therefore I decided I would do it on my own back. The theatre work was going still quite well. I'd started my own little small technical business working in the theatre. And so having qualified as an apprentice of the year and various other things, decided to go on my own for a little while, which in those days was different to now. You paid everybody cash. They knocked on your door on a Friday. And unfortunately the 80s recession hit, and whilst work didn't dry up, cash flow did, and I met my previous wife and she had children and commitments, and I had to go and find myself another proper job. And that's where I went to work for Equitable Life in Aylesbury. They had five buildings in Aylesbury. I was their projects engineer on the, again, the engineering side. And we had a team of in-house technicians, and we did, you know, sort of all the usual stuff that you do in terms of maintenance, but we'd also do some of the project work around the offices as well. In actual fact, we were moving Equitable Life in London. I can't remember actually the streets where they were, went from and to at the time when the bomb went off in London that weekend. So that was quite an experience, believe you me, when we weren't too close. But
I think one of the interesting lessons and one of the things about today pulling out was about how your career did change, but actually it sounds almost, because I can see almost where you're heading now, it's almost small incremental changes rather than you waking up one day and saying, I'm going to go and change my career now. Yeah. You've almost just, drifted is a bad word, but you've almost moved from one skill set and then used that to apply to, so you've gone from where you were on the apprenticeship, you then went into a career with an investor or property owner, and, right. and we can see where it's heading, I think.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And the next step was, I had no idea about shopping centres, and Equitable Life, one of their workshops looks over Friars Square Shopping Centre in Aylesbury. Friends Provident had been redeveloping it. They started to look for a technical services manager. And it seemed like a good thing to go and have a look at, and arrived there 6 months before opening. So got very stuck into all the commissioning and looking at new systems that were in shopping centres rather than in offices. And with the centre manager at the time, built the management team. We opened the scheme and ran it for a year or so until Grosvenor, that were then building Festival Place in Basingstoke, and the natural step was to go from a deputy centre manager, technical services manager in 500,000 square feet shopping centre to be 1 million square feet centre manager, looking after that. So again, just as you say, incrementally shifting those skills, but growing and becoming more broad. I'd have been to college and done a number of things along the way, but I've never done a university degree. I'm not an academic person in that way.
And I think that's really interesting as well, because another little thing to pull out of this is that, and I think it's happening much more now and come full circle, is that you don't need to go to university to do these things. An apprenticeship, and I was approached this week to give a reference to a young a friend's son who's applying for apprenticeships and not going to university, and another good friend is doing an apprenticeship in the city at the moment at one of the big funds, and I think apprenticeships are a fantastic way to learn on the job, and you probably get much more practical skills than you would if you went to university.
Yeah, absolutely, Guy. And I think, you know, that balance of academia against practicalities is probably more important these days than it ever has been. If I'm honest with you, I still look at some of the modern day apprenticeships and wonder whether they're really sort of technical enough, whether they're really focused enough, and whether they're a bit too broad. But, you know, it is nice to see them back and young people having that opportunity.
So Festival Place opened 22nd of October 2002. I got shifted straight onto the Northwestern train and arrived in Liverpool, and the 23rd I was working in Liverpool. But you hung around in Basingstoke for a bit longer.
Yes, I think I did about... Well, it's difficult because it blurred at that point. I think I did 6 months down there, once we'd opened the scheme. And then I got a call to say, would I come to Liverpool for a couple of days a week for about 3 months? Because there were some little bits of property management to try to iron out. So I was very, very honoured to be summoned, and came up here and met our great friend, an ex-colleague, Rod Holmes. I think I then... I did do a couple of days and then went back and then came back again. And wasn't before long that I was up here 5 days a week. I do remember before one summer, it was approaching holiday time, and I was still technically running Festival Place. I was in Liverpool full time, and I had to say to Rod, if when I get off the plane from my holiday, if I don't get clear direction, I'm going back to Basingstoke. And very quickly, I was not working at Basingstoke anymore and full time on Liverpool. And that was hugely exciting, and it was where I was able to really develop a number of my skills and bring different expertise to the team, because obviously my engineering background meant that I could look at all the M&E. I've got a particular focus for sort of electronic systems, so it wasn't just about, you know, pipes and wires and wind and tin. It was also about communications, data, CCTV, access control, all that sort of stuff. And then on top of that, with the management side, how were we going to set the property management up? What was the experience of running two other shopping centres? What was best in class? And then the real great opportunity was actually, how do you bring those two things together? Because you know, we had amazing design teams on the schemes, but very, very little experience of people knowing how actually things operated, and how do you make sure the design actually marries up and fits the operation. That came with its challenges, because sometimes that increased costs, and sometimes it saves costs, but there was quite a lot of discussions on making sure.
So I think it's interesting to pause there, because in the traditional setup you have a development manager who generally manages the funding and the sort of global building finances process effectively. You have the project manager who gets on and delivers, but there's a lack of technical expertise, because the project manager is generally trained in that, managing a project. So actually there has been a missing interface between the technical side, because you bring in consultants. But what we had with Chris, what was really interesting, I think, is that you had somebody who understood the technical side and understood the project management side, which was an incredibly valuable thing that we pulled him into projects when, or problems, when we didn't know what the technical solution was. So it's quite interesting just pulling apart a big team. We had, how many project managers did we have on the Liverpool one?
I think we had 8 or 9 direct project managers working for us. But I think, you know, following on from that, without blowing smoke, the other part of that bow was also understanding what the stakeholder engagement looked like from an operational scheme perspective, because clearly there was yourself and Rod and others all out doing the development stakeholder engagement, but once that development process finishes, it leaves behind another tier. Mm-hmm. So I was one of the first people on the Liverpool bid board and helped them get that getting traction. It wasn't before long I was getting involved in tourism and other stakeholder stuff. Again, that starts to build those long-term relationships and makes that transition out of development into operational.
What we're hearing now is that Chris slowly, so Chris was working on the technical side and did an incredible job there on Liverpool One. And then when we opened Liverpool One, we had to get on and get the management systems in place. And actually Chris, probably a year before we opened, got involved in retail delivery, so getting all the retailers in and making sure that they, you know, could physically deliver their shop fit outs and everything else. And just talk about how, because this is another transition in your career where you went from being project manager with a technical focus through to retail delivery, through to management, scheme opening, and then tell us about what happened then.
Well, I think you know, obviously at the retail delivery part of it, you know, you've got lots of retailers arriving, lots of shop fitters arriving, the main contractor trying to depart, and you know, then there's a big race to the finishing line. So you know, that management of logistics predominantly, but also, you know, you've got the checking of the drawings, you've got the approvals process, you've got the safety management part of it. That's a massive piece of work, particularly on a scheme such as Liverpool. Yeah. And there was a team, and in fact, Chris Renshaw, my business partner, was leading that team for me, you know, back in those days. So, you know, there was a relationship that was cemented back then that's come back together, and perhaps we'll pick up on that shortly, along with retail delivery. But it brings another, you know, string to the bow. But I think, you know, you can't help at these points that I just talk about just a couple of the funny points along that way before we get into post-opening.
So the important thing, I dropped Chris a line yesterday and said we've got to tell a couple of the funny stories. So a bit like you can't get prosecuted in America 1 year after you declared you've been speeding. So people will come out with tales a year ago that they crossed America in like 26 hours or something. We can now talk about some funny stories in Liverpool One that probably we shouldn't have or wouldn't have spoken about openly. But I think the 10 years have moved on and we've settled all the disputes and everything else. There's a couple of good stories here, aren't there?
Yeah, there is. I think the first one, which I think has been told a couple of times, and maybe I'm sure I've heard you tell it, guys, is the one about when we took possession of the open space car park on the east side. I think it was Ash Wednesday that we took over possession. We all then packed ourselves up and took ourselves home for the weekend. Maundy Thursday, some very entrepreneurial Scouser arrived and reopened the car park and traded it for the whole weekend. And once that news hit 70 Grosvenor Street on Tuesday after the Easter weekend, there was all sorts of distressed people. But I think it just goes to show the entrepreneurism that does still exist in Liverpool, and how somebody sees an opportunity and just grabs it. And
we didn't bat an eyelid when we got given the keys on the Wednesday night. That we were going away for Easter weekend. We just expected the car park to be there all locked up on Tuesday morning when we came back to work. And we came back on Tuesday morning to park in our car park, and we were charged £5 to park there. And it was a bit like I said to Chris, it'd been in the press this week about the Bristol Zoo car park, where a man allegedly has been operating that car park for 30 years, and the zoo thought it was the council's car park, and the council thought it was the zoo's car park, and never the twain shall meet. So that was quite an interesting experience. And then there's another story about a public house, isn't there, Chris?
Yes, the public house. This was very early days, actually, wasn't it? We were starting to do site clearance. There was pressure on the project management team to get a move on. The main contractor was starting to demolish some buildings, and I remember one Friday afternoon we all got back in the office, and somebody said, good news guys, that the pub's flattened, it's all gone, you know, we're slightly ahead of schedule. And I think it was your voice that chipped up saying, what pub?
We don't bloody own the pub.
We don't own the pub, was the reply.
So this is a pub that was located on where the John Lewis car park is. So in Liverpool One, the John Lewis car park had an old graveyard in part of it, and it was a surface car park with a pub, and I think Mers Design Partnership were down there as well. So we'd got vacant possession, but we hadn't bought the pub. Then on Monday morning, I got into work and had a call from Max Stone, Frentzen, saying, Guy, I've had a phone call to say my pub has been demolished. And all hell broke loose for a few days while we sorted out that problem. And it did get sorted out, and Max was a good friend right until the end. And we got on. But that was a very challenging moment that my very productive project management colleagues demolished the pub that we didn't own.
You know, we were under pressure to keep the programme. 2008 was on its way.
And he certainly did. So a couple of stories there, a bit of an insight into how bonkers it was during Liverpool One. But tell us a bit about the management of Liverpool One, because so you took over around the middle of 2009, I think, taking on...
Very early 2009, yeah. I was asked to stay. It wasn't my current intention. It goes a bit back to what you're talking about in terms of careers, but clearly we had the massive crash in 2008, and you know, Grosvenor understandably had to change some development decisions. So I was left sort of looking with some fairly specialist project management skills and nothing really to go and work on. And I was very lucky. Chris Tate, a good friend and colleague, asked me whether I would head up the management team, which was great. Big management team. It was obviously I knew the ins and outs because
just pause there. There's some stats. 42.5 acres the whole site.
42.5 acres. Service charge then was around about £10 million. We had 150 people on the payroll.
180 shops. 35,000 restaurants.
Yeah.
500 apartments.
500 apartments, and 3,000 car parking spaces, somewhere around that, and a bus station. Let's never forget the famous bus station. But so a big scheme. We'd set the management team up. It being through the opening phase, and obviously it then needed a huge amount of effort to bed it in, get systems and processes up and running. And those first couple of years, which I thought that it was just going to be a couple of years for me managing it, really went by in a flash of an eye, because there was a huge amount to do, massive amount of stakeholder engagement work to do, as long as working with the team, and some amazing things along the way. I mean, it wasn't unusual in those days that I'd get a call from the late Duke's private secretary to say that he'd like to come and see Liverpool. He would often pop in if he was on private engagements, and that was a huge honour for me, because that didn't happen really in the rest of Grosvenor for those types of calls. And we developed a relationship there that was particularly special, and Liverpool was special to him.
Well, just pausing on that as well. I mean, the Duke got involved quite a bit during the project from the start because he was passionate about Liverpool.
Yep.
And then we had some vociferous but friendly relationships with, or vociferous objectors to, the compulsory purchase, and he got involved in those. Quiggins, he came and met them personally and was involved in that. And then when the visitors came, he quite often came up and joined people on visits, in high profile visits.
Absolutely.
And then once the scheme was opened, he continued to show an interest.
He did, very much so. And you know, he used to come and look at the scheme and see what was going on, talk to the team. He used to love spending time with the team. I do remember being told off once when I knew he was off to another appointment, and I said, "Sir, you know, we need to get going." And he said, "I can tell the time, and I'll go when I want to go." Sort of put me in my place very quickly. But no. And then on the other side of it, you know, he was a very philanthropic person. He hated that word. In fact, he didn't want to be ever known as a philanthropist, but he was. But you know, we used to get involved in all sorts of things, and I was involved in setting up the Liverpool One Foundation, and to this day it is still co-funded by the Westminster Foundation, run by Community Foundation for Lancashire and Merseyside, of which I'm a trustee. And it does some amazing works with grassroots charities across Merseyside. So that was great. But I think, you know, if you just look back, and it's more than 10 years now, over the management and what's changed and happened. I mean, I certainly remember during the project design phases, you know, we were talking about BREEAM, sort of very good and excellence. And, you know, if we managed to get very good, we were very good. And occasionally we touched on excellence. Nowadays, you know, certainly in the Grosvenor world, it outstanding is the only value. And I think the whole environmental agenda, the green agenda, LED lighting was really in its infancies in 2006, and expensive. And nowadays, I mean, look, we've just fitted this office out. There isn't one old style lamp in here at all. You know, they're all
and LEDs did go wrong back then.
They did. And now, you know, you're putting them in with confidence for 10 years, and you'll never touch them again. So, you know, massive. That from that side, it's moved on a lot. I think also, and you'll probably know better than I do, Guy, the investor expectation on the green agenda has moved on massively. We've just been tendering for a piece of work, which, touch wood, we might hear today, where the vast majority of the interview was all around our green credentials and our environmental, and how do we use chemical-free products? How do we recycle the packaging that comes for it, etc., etc., etc.? And that's all being driven by the investor world now, because they want to be as green as possible. They know it's important. They know the social conscience that comes with
impact. There's two elements. There's the what and the how, the impact and the theme of what you're investing in. And it's we're certainly absolutely putting a lot of resource into that at the moment. But did that change quite early on, or was that just something gradual?
I think it's fairly gradual. If I'm honest with you, I don't think it changed early on. I think it was quite slow, and I think probably it's only as we've seen national and international pressures over the last probably 5 or 6 years that it's really gathered pace. Mm. I mean, I might have got my timescale slightly wrong there, but certainly in the early days, I think it wasn't quite lip service, but I think it was sort of getting to, okay, well, we need to start thinking a little bit more about that. But now it's an absolute, you know, there's not there. And of course, health and safety's gone on the same journey, hasn't it? And, you know, there's some things we do now that are just part of our daily routines. And yet in those days, we were having to have check sheets and checking and proving that we were doing various things. And I think, you know, two other points really in terms of where management's gone. Transparency, you know, certainly when you're running service charge now, making sure you're as open and as consultative as you possibly can be, making sure that you're looking out for the best interest for the tenants and the occupiers, the end users, as well as the investor and the landlord. And that's a tricky balance really when you're trying to do it. And if you're lucky enough to work with great people who believe in longevity of buildings and looking for medium to longer term, then that's fantastic. But when you do have the pressures of sort of short-term holds and people wanting to gain value, which is understandable, you know, trying to manage those, you know, those dichotomies that do come in is tricky. And I think the final thing, I touched on it earlier, is about that whole corporate social responsibility piece. And you know, sort of the Liverpool One Foundation was really, I think it was groundbreaking, and how we stitched that grant making, that local grant making, that real need. I mean, there's still huge deprivation around the Liverpool City region, and real need to get money to grassroots organisations that do amazing work out there. But how do you bolt that grant making into getting your team and your staff to understand the need? How do you give back to the community? How do you actually help the community help you in training, mentoring, volunteering, and actually making a complete 360 sort of package of activity?
Just one thing there, actually, I just wasn't planning to talk about it, was the Prince's Trust that we both worked on. And that's a good example of how amazing Grosvenor was to work for, really, in the sense of, I'd been approached with a requirement to find them some accommodation. We had a building which we put them into terms of Renshaw Street, I think it was
and still there.
You pulled together effectively a load of goodwill in terms of contractors, consultants, your own time, which was a massive input, and we delivered them a complete new home in Liverpool. And any other company you wouldn't be allowed to, or wouldn't be supported in doing but the value we pulled together, or you did specifically, around 200 grand's worth of goodwill, I suspect.
I think there was at least that. I think it might have been quite a bit more. It's memory's fading a little bit. And I also remember that you told me that I was getting involved in a small little project where there might need to borrow the odd toilet and door from somewhere to tart it up. And I got a feeling the value was about £500,000 worth of
work. But it was an amazing project and a long-lasting legacy to the city. And I think there was lots of examples there. And that's not just one. There's, we could probably give 20 examples of things that the team did during the project, which was phenomenal. So let's just move on. Have you got anything else to say on Liverpool One?
No, not particularly.
Let's just talk about your sort of last, what was happening, why you left Liverpool One. Not that there's a lot to talk about there, but really mainly about the burning light of going on your own and what your desires were there,
and
what is Momentum, and why you're doing it, and why is it different from any other consultants?
Okay. I mean, let's start with the end of Liverpool One. I mean, it's not the end of the Liverpool One at all, but my time with Liverpool One was very, very simply, I was rapidly approaching 50. I'd done 10 years managing Liverpool One. I'd done 15 years on the Liverpool One project. I'd done 20 years with Grosvenor, and I was ready for a new challenge. I mean, it was still a massive challenge. It was a lot of hard work. It remains a lot of hard work, but I was ready to do something different. I had a look around the UK at what was around, and to be perfectly honest with you, I've become very settled in Liverpool. I love the place, I love the people, and that meant a lot to me.
So one thing that none of the listeners will know, we've got Chris's daughter, 8-year-old daughter Christelle here, and she sat quietly with her headphones on reading an Enid Blyton book, I think. She's been amazing. Yeah. To be honest, she's been an absolute star. But probably the biggest reason is Chris has settled down here and has a lovely young daughter and a family and is settled in Liverpool. So.
Absolutely. And that comes with a lot of pressure, as everybody knows that works in the project world. And I couldn't find anything that was right for me or for the family. I decided that actually, I thought I'll scratch that itch that you always have when you've had your own business in the past. Mine was very small and a long time before. And I was very lucky. I spoke to Grosvenor. I was hugely supportive. We had conversations long before I left about how the transition might work. I was enabled to negotiate some work with them. I also managed to negotiate some work with another developer, YPG, in the early days. And that was enough to actually make me take my step out of the PAYE payslip world into the fee earning world, I guess. And then very quickly, Chris Renshaw, who we mentioned earlier, got in touch. He saw me on LinkedIn, the great networking LinkedIn, saying, actually, I'm working for Mace and I've got the same itch and I would like to come back to the Northwest. And we thought, do you know what? Two heads are better than one. I had a conversation with you, Guy, about, you know, what should I do? Should I go into a 50-50 partnership? And you gave me some very wise words.
Well, I remember the call. I was in Glasgow, in a hotel in Glasgow, and we had a conversation about it. And I recited to you something that Rod Holmes, our great leader from Liverpool, one told me, and I remember when he told me, we were sat outside the Hilton in the cafe that was opposite the Hilton having a drink one day, and he said that there's a statistic of success in businesses when there's one person and then there's two people together, two leaders or one leader, and it's something like 75% success rate with two people and 25% success rate on your own. And I thought, well, that was a really interesting stat which I shared with you, and we've applied it at Glenbrook, and you're applying it here.
Absolutely. And alongside that, you said to me, you know, a problem shared is a problem halved, and two heads are better than one. And I think all those three are absolutely bang on. And I certainly got no regrets, and I'm pretty sure Chris hasn't got any regrets either. But so we set Momentum up, the Momentum Group. It wasn't actually known as the Momentum Group then, because we set up our first business. We've got four now. Really looking at, you use the word consultancy. I prefer to use the word advisory, because I think it's just a slightly nicer way of describing it. But we did some project management work. We do retail delivery work. And we do some general building surveying, a tiny little bit of quantity surveying, but we were also just doing general property advice. So in the same way as I was advising Grosvenor pre-opening Liverpool One, we still advise you and I on Mayfields in Manchester, development on property management setup and what the structure will look like there. And we have other clients who just simply come to us and say, I've got this conundrum, I've got this challenge, what should we be doing? And just helping them out there. But quite quickly, we form Momentum and Build. It's a small construction company. We saw a gap in the market because sort of in 2008, what we class as the tier three contractors all disappeared. Lots of people in white vans working very hard, but nobody really wanting to do that sort of £250,000 to £3 million. So Momentum Build sort of fits that gap. And then more recently, we've set up the Momentum Property Management, does exactly what it says in the tin, and we're delighted that we've got 35 residential apartments just down the road from here under management. We hope to get another 80 fairly shortly this year. And we're also very lucky that we took over the management of Temple Square under your direction. Thank you very much. At the beginning of this year, so it's our first commercial building, and hopefully there might be a few more that follow. And then to fit the set, and this is where we think we're unique, we form Momentum FM that does exactly that. It provides facilities management, whether it's cleaning, concierge, M&E maintenance, small works, to a number of clients. And as I said, Momentum FM is waiting for here as a result of a very exciting tender today. So I can't tell you too much about that right now, but watch this space, because it will be good for us, really, really, really good. And with it, we think we're unique in that because, you know, you might have seen from Christelle's drawing that we advise, we build, we manage and we maintain. And we're not sure that we can find anybody that actually does all four. There's a lot of people out there that will do a combination of the three. But we actually think that that gives that 360 degree perspective, and we can pass those skill sets. We see it as a menu. It's not, you know, we're not precious. We do work with people that you know, do the property management and we do the FM, or we do the project management and somebody else does the construction. It's not about domination and taking all the work for ourselves. It's actually about where are we best placed to fit into the property jigsaw with our clients. And a little bit like the the DNA that we've both sort of taken out of Grosvenor, we're looking for long-term relationships. So we're not out there for the really quick wins. We like to work with our clients. We like to develop a relationship. You kindly introduce us to Appreciate Group, and that's a real case in point that you know, they started their life with us as the Park Group, actually, over at Birkenhead. And initially, it was a small piece of work to help them project manage their move to 20 Chapel Street. And we've done some construction work with them. We've done some facilities management work. We've got a piece of work running for them today, and they've just given us some more in a couple of weeks' time. And that relationship is really now developing nicely into something, hopefully, that will become embedded in both our businesses' DNA, and it will be there for a long time.
What I also think is very interesting, and be interested to hear about your thoughts on, is that you came and moved into Temple at an interesting time when COVID was changing the way people worked. You've taken an amazing office floor here and fitted it out to exacting standards, which is a showcase for your business. But you've done things differently, I think, and things are different when you go and walk around the office here. Just talk to us about your thoughts about how you've developed that, designed it and built it, and what the how working has changed, because it is different, I think.
Yeah, it was kind of you to say that, and I think it was a difficult decision, if I'm honest with you, because we've still got offices in Liverpool One. We always knew they were a bit too small. They weren't quite fit for purpose. They're absolutely ideal for our project work that we do there, and we'll still use it as our project office. But COVID hit, and everybody, you know, had to lock down. But we're a live business that has to be out there. We're allowed to work in our offices under the government guidelines. But we couldn't get enough people in it safely. We wanted to grow, so we knew that even, you know, parks the safety just slightly to one side for the moment, actually we're going to have to do something. We started looking around, and we looked at a number of places, and we found this, and it fitted our needs in terms of, you know, the deal we've done with you and the scope and size. And then we said to ourselves, well, actually, you know, the likelihood is that COVID-19 will at some point run its course, but what's to say that, you know, there won't be another, heaven forbid, dare I say it, a pandemic or something similar in the not too distant future? And should we, before we engage the design team, should we actually set our stall out to say that we want to get as close to, you know, sort of a future-proofed office for this type of thing that goes on? And so immediately, you know, the brief was it needs to be open plan, it needs to be airy, it needs to be light, we need to give people space. We've actually got designs in the carpet, we've got red stripes running down it that are 2 metres apart, just as that visual clue, this is how much space we should have apart from us. None of the desks touch each other, everybody sits with more than 2 metres away from each other. We've actually got trees growing between the desks, and that probably sounds really odd to listeners. They are potted trees, but the whole idea of again, the green agenda, a healthy office. We've tried to design it so that there are multiple ways of moving around the office. Clearly, there is one restriction, which is there's only one door in and out, so that gives us a small challenge. But we also wanted to make it a place where you actually felt at home. You know, it isn't that corporate big office, because that's not what we are. We like to think we're a friendly and caring business. We spend a lot of time trying to care for our staff and understand their needs and thinking about the staff that will come and join us in the future. So we built a nice big kitchen area so people can, well, when safely, they can sit and have a cup of coffee together, or somebody pops in and you just sit in the kitchen and have a cup of coffee. We've got our larger sort of town hall space, which is more for sort of team meetings and gatherings, a little breakout area, and then a very generous sized director's office where we're sat now, but it's got the table in the middle that's a little bit more formal. And Chris and I often talk about that this room needs to have the bank manager test, so, you know, when we're under the cosh, or we want to borrow some money or whatever, or we've got a new investor, a new client, then we feel that we're bringing them into a space that reflects our business, but also somewhere I think that's likely to reflect their business. You know, I'd like to think that any one of our clients, managing directors, chief execs, chairmen could come in here and feel that they could associate with us as a service provider. And you know, so far, including yourself, we've had some great compliments, and it should set us up very well for the future. We've got enough space to expand as we go, and we hope to expand.
I think the really impressive thing is, from the outside, the building is a very historic building. It's Grade 2 listed, very interesting building, but you'd expect it to be quite stuffy inside. And you come inside and it's beautiful. It really is big floor to ceilings, lots of daylight coming into the building. And it's a really nice contemporary office fit out you've done. So I like it's a great advert for us. You know, I'm very proud of this building. Great advert for us to see such a contemporary fit out inside, you know, a fairly institutional looking building. It looks like an old bank. It's not an old bank, I don't think, but it looks like an old bank. And we've got a cafe basement and there's a dentist at one side, and then an office all the way up the building, and a mix of tenants. But we're really proud about, from the street, you can see into Momentum Group, and it's great. We're really proud of that. So well done on doing
that.
Thank you. So as we wrap up, slowly head towards finishing, I just thought I'd find out a bit more about you, Chris, because I think your passion is skiing, is that right?
Yes, it is, and it's a very raw passion at the moment, because obviously...
What's that, Chris, skiing?
Obviously COVID's prevented any travel, really, for nearly everybody for a long time now, so... I used to ski a lot. In fact, going back to the Liverpool One days, I was very lucky that I used to actually commute home to my apartment in France during the construction phase of it, and skied an awful lot during that time. I was very, very lucky. These days, it's not quite so much, but you know, as a family, we would generally go every Christmas and every Easter, and our summer holidays would be in the Alps as well. So we were there last Christmas, but this was the first Christmas in 15 years, I think, other than when Christelle was born, that we haven't been sat in our apartment looking at snow and mountains. So I miss it. I love it. I love being outside anyway. I'm not a person to be inside, and I guess that's probably also a bit of attraction of the office being sort of big and airy.
And actually, it's one of those things at Liverpool One, I always remember, you would walk the floor. I bet paces-wise, because we've had the Glenbrook pace competition in January.
Yeah.
And I bet you were doing 20,000 paces a bloody day.
Oh, easily. Absolutely easily. Yeah, absolutely. You didn't have smart watches then, so you didn't really know. But no, I mean, the team will tell you here that they struggle to keep me away from where what I call the action is, and not sat at my desk, which is probably where I should be, because I just prefer to be outside. You know, I often, well, every day now I try to do a good hour's fast, brisk walk, and get as much exercise. I'm not a hugely sporty person. I do like to watch the rugby. I'll be watching the Six Nations this weekend, but really my sporting passion is the skiing. And as I say, my second choice would be then a good walk. It would be nice to get back up into the mountains or the peaks or something when we're allowed to drive a little bit further in due course. Occasionally you can persuade me to get my bike out, and you'll remember the London to Liverpool bike ride.
So just quickly, this is a great story. We decided, as we used to see, put money into the foundation, effectively,
wasn't it?
And so we did a lot of fundraising at Grosvenor, and somebody came up with the idea that let's get a group of people to cycle from London to Liverpool over 2.5 days, I think it was. And it was phenomenal. And the people who pulled into that or contributed, I did a little bit of it, I didn't do it all. I did a bit of it, but it was a big undertaking. And we all came through the tunnel.
We did. It was a huge highlight. And it was interesting, actually, because I mean, I would never class myself as super fit and never thought I could probably really do that sort of stuff. But you do all the training beforehand and you get yourself psyched up. But if I'm honest, the first day hurt me the most. We stopped for lunch just outside Chalfont St Giles, I think, and I really didn't think I was going to carry on. I don't quite know, you know, probably just getting some sugar and some food inside me. And interestingly, you actually felt yourself fitter, getting fitter as you went on, you know, over the next couple of days. And and I guess the adrenaline's building up, because I remember leaving overnight stop just outside Chester and riding into Liverpool and arriving at the tunnel. You know, that final ride in was an amazing.
I was quite fearful of going through the tunnel, because I was thinking, how the hell do you get up the other side? You can go down down the hill, but actually there's a wind pressure, an air pressure that pushes you up the hill. So actually, it didn't even notice the uphill bit.
No.
That was an incredible experience. So we've covered your early career. We've covered Basingstoke, Liverpool One. We've covered Momentum Group and forming that. Is there anything else? What's the journey going ahead? I mean, where do we see Momentum in 10 years' time?
Who knows, Guy? I mean, listen, you can tell from my journey and my career that I've never really had a big long-term plan. I'd like to think that we will continue to grow. I definitely want us to be still around in 10 years' time. We're 3 years old now, so I think we're just coming past that sort of high-risk point.
Yeah.
We've got an amazing team. They work incredibly hard. We're already looking for more good people to come and join us. We're ambitious. We've got our eyes on some big prizes over the next couple of years. So hopefully we just carry on cementing what we do and we become a market leader in what we do across the Northwest. We'll start, obviously we're already looking at Liverpool, we'll start to go more city region over the next year or so and then push out across the Northwest in due course. So,
Thank you, Chris. I'm very proud of what you've achieved and
I'm
very lucky to have you as a friend and also a colleague. So thank you very much for doing this. To all our listeners, please subscribe to the Glenbrook podcast. We've got many more good ones to come. And thank you for listening to Chris and I today.
Thank you, Guy.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.